A listener production.
This is From Zero, where I get the real stories behind some of Australia's best business successes. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of LuxuryEscapes.com, financial journalist, author, and angel investor. With my best mate from school, we co-founded Luxury Escapes, and the business has grown to turn over almost $500 million annually without raising a dollar of outside capital. People ask me all the time, how do we start the business? And now I want to turn the tables. In this episode, I speak with Pete Cleary from Zinc.
A business can't just be about making profit. It has to be about creating value, and I fundamentally believe in that to the every fibre of my being.
Pete Cleary is real-life proof that nice guys don't always finish last. Pete created one of Australia's most innovative brand and marketing companies called Zinc, and he's built the business into a giant. But growing up, he came from far more humble beginnings. Pete's dad was an electrical engineer and owned his own small business. His mum brought up Pete and his five siblings. There are three boys, three girls, two bedrooms, and only one bathroom between them. Being part of such a big family meant Pete was an industrious kid. He had his own lawn mowing business, he washed dishes in the pub, and one year, when the family lemon tree had a bumper crop, he and his brother rode around the neighbourhood selling lemons out of the back of a cart. He made his first investment in the share market by the time he was 14, and he knew he always wanted to own his own small business. Pete went to uni and studied economics and politics. He didn't know what he wanted to do, so when it came time to getting a real job, he wound up working for a family friend in his marketing business.
That company was called Promotive Marketing, and it was a terrific company. Like, Pete Grogan is the guy that created the company as it was by the time I got there, and he's a mentor today. Like, he's a shareholder in Zinc, my current company, and he was the guy when I started Zinc. He was the guy I asked to be chairman. And he's a terrific, he's almost like a second or a third dad to me, because he showed me the way that business can be done, that it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. For me to win, someone has to lose. He showed that you could be kind and generous and run a business ethically and with strong morals. And he really cared about people. Like, he looked after people. And that was my entrance into my first job. I was very lucky to have someone that took a genuine interest in people and cared for people and genuinely look after you, as well as being successful and learning a lot, because he was a good businessman as well.
How big was Promotive at the time you went to work for them, and what were you doing?
Well, I started as a account coordinator or manager, I can't remember. I don't know, maybe there was 15 or 20 people. It was a company based in Mount Waverley in Melbourne. And it was very successful. He'd grown year on year. He used to have between 5 and 7% growth each year. And he had a partner, a guy by the name of Mike Doran, and they complemented each other's, you know, strengths and weaknesses well. And those guys had grown that business for about 10 years to the point where when it was finally sold in 2000, it was probably an $8 million business with about 30, 35 people. So, and I'd worked there for, 5 or 6 years, and just started as someone who didn't know anything, as you don't. And we used to sell promotional merchandise to companies, and there was a lot of cold calling because you had to build your own client base. And we used to jump in our car and drive around. Like, it was a very different world then, and it was very manual, and you'd be driving around everywhere, seeing clients and picking things up and dropping samples. And it was a terrific place to hone your people skills and your sales and marketing skills as well, which is what happened. And maybe after about 12 or 18 months, I asked Pete that I thought there was a way, because we used to be paid 100% commission. So again, it was a different way of working than how we do currently.
But so you weren't getting any base at all. If you didn't bring in the business, you got paid nothing?
We had a 6-month introduction where you'd get a small wage, and then what the methodology for the sales team at the time was that, and it was quite generous, is that you could you would get a percentage of the gross profit that you generated over and above your base. But the base was very low, and it was structured that way to encourage you to get out there and sell. And then once you were on, once you were comfortable and you had a client base after 12 months, you were then basically on 100% commission, and that's how we worked.
So you were essentially knocking on doors, potentially. You're a pretty small kid, a 22-year-old kid knocking on doors of big businesses trying to sell stuff. Was that
basically? How did you do that? Yeah, that was basically what was happening, and you're 100% commission based. But there was a great support network in the office. And Pete was always there, and like he'd be putting in 120% to be helping you do whatever it is that needed to be done. And it worked really well. Like there was some, you know, there was probably an account management team of five or six people, like senior account managers, and they had support teams underneath them by the time we finally sold the business. And it was a tremendously successful way to approach it. But I remember after probably about a year and a half or 2 years, and maybe I've always had an entrepreneurial flair, I'd worked out that if I could spend more time talking to clients and more time talking to people and less time on admin in the office, I could actually make more money, and more money for the business and more money for myself. So I said to Pete, look, could I hire someone and pay for them out of my commission and keep growing the business? And that hadn't happened before. And he said, look, that seems like it's a good idea. And so we ended up doing that. And then that started a different model of the business, where people were then paying for direct support people out of their commission. But I remember doubling my salary in the next 12 months just by doing that. So I could be more time out talking to clients and doing deals rather than doing the paperwork or processing the administration.
So at that time, you're in your early mid-20s. How much were you earning?
I'll tell you. I think Pete would kill me, but we were probably 150, 200 grand a year, which was an enormous amount of money at that time.
And this is back in the early 90s, I'm guessing, or mid-90s.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it was phenomenal. And people were well remunerated. It was terrific. And I was driving a $1,500 Datsun 1600. I used to have to park it around the corner and not drive into clients' car parks because it was embarrassing. But, you know, this was after about 2 or 3 years you would be on that sort of money. But, again, it was all risk. If something happened to that client, or you weren't generating revenue, or you would earn literally nothing. So it was a generous cut to the account manager, but it was a very unusual entrance into working, because most people don't have that sort of experience.
So in 2000, the business was sold for a pretty good sum.
Yeah. So we went through probably about 2 years after that. I initially put on an account coordinator. We then put on another one, and we just kept building the team. And the guys at Promotive, the different account managers, they were doing the same sort of thing. We were all doing the same thing then. I then knocked on the door of Pete's office again and said, instead of buying a house, I knocked on the door and said to Pete, could we buy into the business? Because I thought the business was terrific, and I could see that, you know, I didn't know anything about this business 3 or 4 years before, but you could see that it was fantastic and it had a great future and the ethos was good and the company was great. So I said, can we buy in? And it was a very lucky time at that stage that Pete's original partner, Mike Doran, was potentially looking to sell out. So there ended up being some room for us to actually buy into the company, and we scraped together as much money as we possibly could, which wasn't much, and we bought 10%, I think it was, of Promotive, or 15, I can't quite remember. And if I had been able to buy more, I would have. But that was my first lesson in understanding that, you know, you need money to make money. Because if I'd have been the son of a wealthy businessman, as opposed to, you know, growing up in Forest Hill, I think, you know, today you'd be, even with the success we've had, you'd be in a very different position. Maybe you would have won and lost a lot more money, but it was a very good lesson early that you need money to make money. And so I could see investing in Promotive was going to be a better way than buying a house, and that's through the investments that I've done over the years. And so that's what we did. And that was a year before we got an offer that we couldn't refuse in, I think it was about 2000.
You were recently married at the time, and was Michelle very supportive of this, or was she saying, Pete, we can buy a great house now and you're letting it ride on a promotions business? Well, was that a tough conversation, or was it a really easy decision for you back in 1999 to let it roll on a business where you'd just been a sort of a pretty up-and-coming sales guy?
Yeah, no, that's right. No, it was a very tough conversation. Well, it wasn't tough. We're very different. So Michelle is... She's a fantastic person, and she just completed her architecture degree at Melbourne Uni, and so she was a practicing architect at that stage, and her level of risk is very different to mine, which we didn't realise at that time. I mean, you get married, you're in love, you know, you're thinking from your own mental framework, and I thought everyone had my level of risk, which I've since found out that they clearly don't. So from Michelle's perspective, she'd seen her father, her own dad, have ups and downs in business, and she'd seen, you know, what the down looked like, and she was a lot more risk adverse and really didn't want to do it. She was much happier to sort of go the normal expected route of buying a house and, you know, getting a job and just paying that off. But from my perspective, it was a real fire in the belly, I guess, with regard to not wanting to go down that path at all. So, no, we had some really challenging discussions early on, but to her credit, she was absolutely fantastic. And we had to borrow, you know, as much money as you would for a deposit on a decent house. But instead of buying a house, we were putting into a business that you know, could do anything. So it was a big risk, and she really pushed outside of her comfort zone, which we've both done, you know, since we got married over 20 years ago. And it's been a pretty consistent theme where if one of us has wanted to do something and push outside that comfort zone, we generally have supported the other, but it's certainly not been without the conversations that we had. And we certainly had some early in those days, but we did it, and it was the best thing we ever did.
In the early 2000s, Promotive was sold to an American company called Corporate Express. At that time, Promotive didn't have a national footprint or even a website, and they couldn't compete against gigantic American business. So Pete and the team had made the logical move to sell the business. Pete will continue to work for Corporate Express and even moved up to Sydney to head up their new office up there.
I asked one of the account managers from here, a guy by the name of Rick Gall, to come up with me, and he took a risk and did that, which was great. And so we went up to Sydney, you know, had a team of four or five people in this small promotional business, and that was the nucleus of the new New South Wales business. But my brief was national to grow this new division of Corporate Express as quickly and as profitably as we could. So we then set about over the next 4.5 years to make a number of acquisitions in different states and to develop a global footprint using the Staples network in both Australia and New Zealand, which is what we did.
And how did you like the role? Was it, so you were doing, I guess, a more senior role? Was it? Did you see yourself as a person who could soon be leading a business?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely loved it. Like, moving to Sydney was fantastic. And part of moving to Sydney, like, from my perspective, is we did a deal with Michelle where she'd been practicing an architect for a few years then, and whilst she really enjoyed it, it wasn't her first love. She liked aspects of it, like the design, but there was a lot of things she didn't like, and she'd always wanted to be an archaeologist. So the deal was, if we moved to Sydney for my work, is that she could do her PhD in archaeology and become an archaeologist. And so that's exactly what we did. So we moved to Sydney with no kids, and it was one of the best times of our lives. It's a fantastic place to live. We ended up settling in a suburb called Coogee, which is near the beach, which is fantastic. And it was a terrific time in terms of working very hard, but in enjoying what we were doing. And the business was growing exponentially across a number of different areas. And they had this one source solution business model for all the non-direct factors of production for any corporate in Australia. So they were targeting the top 200 ASX companies and wanted to provide all the non-direct factors of production that business would need. So they started originally as a stationery business, and then they went into, and then it broadened into what they called office supplies. And then they went into a range of things like janitorial and cleaning and liquor, and then promotional merchandise was one of these categories. Also furniture, IT hardware. So it was this broad one source solution model, which had some logic to it for sure. And we were probably one of the fastest growing divisions within that, but always relatively small because the stationery side and the office supply side was the bigger division of that business.
So you're having the time of your lives in Sydney, young married couple, and corporate stress doing really well, and you're doing really well. And then a few years later, you say, well, I think it's time to come back to Melbourne and do my own thing.
Yeah, no, well, it was actually funny because I remember the first two or three years, the learnings were fantastic. So what I basically had is I'd come from a small, moralistic, well-governed company but had a narrower focus and sort of didn't really have a growth impetus. It sort of managed its profitability through expenses and wasn't a big risk-taking business, to then going to a publicly listed company, which is what it was, and where the balance sheet was quite strong and there wasn't any capital limitations if you had a good idea, whereas in a small business, there's always lots of capital limitations. So I got this taste of what having a strong balance sheet looks like. And while at Corporate Express, I made something like 5 acquisitions, and we grew that division of Corporate Express from the 7 or 8 million at Promotive to about 65 or 70 million within 4.5 years. Half of that growth was acquisition, half of that growth was organic. And so what it did was open my eyes to what's possible if you have a different perspective, if you think on a different scale, and if you have access to capital. So again, it was coming back to that personal lesson of you need money to make money. And what it also did was give me insight at a senior level to a lot of ASX-listed, top 100 companies at senior management level, because these were all our clients. Anyone that you can think of in the top 200, Corporate Express was dealing with maybe 100 of those. And what it showed me was that the culture in a lot of these business and it wasn't as what I expected it to be. And it also showed me that a lot of people, when they're making decisions in some of these large corporates, are doing it from their own perspective as opposed to thinking of it from the business perspective or a broader perspective that's outside of their own interests. So, and this also I saw within Corporate Express, there was a terrific guy by the name of Ted Nark, who was an American who was the CEO at the time when I moved up, and he was fantastic. He had a similar philosophy to Pete Grogan. He was very well respected and well regarded, and he had integrity and all the values that you'd expect in a good leader, and he really was terrific. And I, at that stage, honestly thought that maybe leading a company at some stage, being a CEO or a senior executive in a top 100 Australian company, is what I'd like to do. But over those next sort of couple of years, that perspective started to temper. And then at one stage, maybe about a year and a half before I left Corporate Express, Ted ended up going back to the United States, and he was succeeded. And it was a different world under the new CEO, and it was a world that I really didn't like. Values changed, the culture changed, there was a whole range of things changed. And what I then started to see is that this is the way that a lot of businesses are operating, and I'd seen that in some of the clients that we were exposed to at senior levels as well. So this is where it became apparent that, you know, I had a decision to make from a personal perspective, and this came to a head one day when I saw the head of one of the divisions get fired. And the way it was done, and I think it was amoral, and it wasn't. It was typical corporate stuff where, you know, it was just a headshot sort of a scenario, and it just moved on. There was no process to try and make it work. There was no goodwill involved. It was political. There was machinations in the background. It was about protecting turf of people internally in the organisation at the time at a senior level. There was some non-performance, sure, but it was also someone arbitrarily made a decision And then that decision was carried out. And so when that happened, and I remember talking to the guy that was fired, because I'd seen him walking down the corridor towards me, and he was literally crying. And there were people, as he was passing, who were pretending not to see him cry, which is just remarkable, you know. And these were people who were colleagues and friends. So I said to – his name was Graham, and I said to Graham, are you okay? What's wrong? And he told me what had happened, and I couldn't do anything to help him. But that's when I realised this place probably wasn't for me. And I realised that the rules of the corporate game are not set up to get the best out of people. They're best, you know, a lot of companies are set up, or a lot of traditionally corporate companies, large companies are set up to extract value out of people, and they're cogs in a wheel. And it doesn't allow people to be human or be themselves and to care about people in a way that you would expect normal people would care about each other. So that's when I realised that this leadership and this company wasn't, the new company wasn't for me. And that's when I started thinking about I needed to do something else, which I then communicated to the CEO at the time. And we agreed to disagree on a number of things. And I gave 6 months' notice, which was an extraordinary long period of time to give, but I wanted to look after the team that was there.
Pete was now in his early 30s. And for the first time in his adult life, he had to stop and think about what he wanted to do. He shadowed a merchant banker, worked in a real estate agent's office, and almost started working at an advertising agency. But Pete realised the culture he wanted to work in was a culture he needed to build himself from the ground up. So he spent 2 months writing a business plan, and the first 5 pages of that plan weren't filled with revenue forecast or new product ideas. Instead, he dedicated them to imagining the culture he wanted to create. Pete approached investors to fund the business and was able to raise almost $2 million in seed capital. With his old boss, Pete Grogan, coming on board as chairman, Pete was ready to build his new business. The business was called Zinc. It would specialise in promotional and loyalty marketing to help big and small companies retain customers and activate new brands. You might remember things like the VB Live Cricket Watch or the Cadbury Joy Mug. These were all created by Zinc. Or if you go to a cinema and drink a Coke out of a Toy Story or Avengers cup, the chances are it was Zinc that created that experience, by bringing together the production company like Warner Brothers or Disney with the cinema chain and their manufacturing partners in China. This wasn't too dissimilar to what Pete and the team were doing at Corporate Express, but culturally, the two businesses couldn't have been any more different. The way you run your business is very uncorporate, and I think obviously part of your experience at Corporate Express drove this. So you don't people don't need to take sick days. They can just not come in. You can just choose not to come in even. You get free breakfast, free lunches, free massages, free gym. This isn't sort of Silicon Valley, which is commonplace. It's pretty unusual for business in Australia to do this kind of stuff for the team. And obviously it's costly. Was this always going to be the case? Is this hard, especially when you obviously have good times and bad times in a business? And during a good time, you can give this stuff away. During a bad time, potentially it's to other partners and other shareholders go, well, Pete, you're spending a lot on this, on these free breakfasts.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it comes down to the type of business you're trying to build. So for me, our business is built on a philosophy of shared value, which is a Michael Porter concept. And that philosophy is, and I didn't know this when we started it, but instinctively we were doing some of these things, and then it became very clear, maybe about 5 years into Zinc operating, post when we launched 2005, is I came across this concept and it was like a light bulb going on. It was, I could suddenly see what we were doing more clearly, and it gave more of a framework. The key premise behind a shared value business is that a business can't just be about making profit. It has to be about creating value, and I fundamentally believe in that to the every fibre of my being. And this was implicit in the business plan that I'd written 5 years before and shared with everyone that had come on board. And as I said, the first 5 pages are dedicated to what that culture looks like. And what I'd inadvertently done is focus on the execution without having the strategy or the framework clear. And what this concept of shared value did was give me that strategy on which to hang it. So once you've got that strategy clear, the good times and the bad times, you adapt your business to suit what environments it's in. And an example of that is, yes, we do some of those things that you talk about, which are the superficial things, really, that sort of people understand. But these are built on a bedrock of having a great purpose that aligns people to what that, you know, end goal or vision is. And it's also got to be a shared values that people have as a bedrock of any business. So when times are good, we're able to share the value that the business creates. And we share that in a way that's unique and different with all the key stakeholders in our business. And from team members' perspective, that means we can afford to do some of the things that you've just mentioned before, which are the superficial things. But when times are bad, we can't afford to do those things. It's like a household budget. You've got to tighten your belt. So when times are bad, we go back to the team and say, hey, we can't do some of these things for these reasons. And then because we've built our business on this philosophy and people understand that when they join, it gives us great flexibility as a business to adapt what our expenses are and how we manage the business. And it's the same with our shareholders. Like when people are investing in the business, they understand the premise on which the business is built. You don't buy, if you don't buy into that premise, don't invest in this business.
So it's 2016 and you guys are just becoming, I think, the fifth best place to work in Australia. Everything's going really well. You've got a lovely family, your business is growing really well, and suddenly, probably for the first time in a while, things stopped going so well. So the trajectory of the business sort of turned around a bit. Can you talk a bit more about what happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'd made the decision. We'd made the decision in about 2014, 2015, that Australia was a small market. We'd learned a lot of lessons from scale, like in terms of going back to some of my earlier experiences at Corporate Express, and saying, well, we can have whatever success we can here, and maybe we can grow this in Australia to a 25 or a 30 or a $35 million business even. Now, that would be fantastic, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if we do the same actions in a market that's 10 times the size, could we possibly have a business that is 10 times as large? And the short answer is, well, yes, you can. You've just got to change your perspective and you've got to think differently, but you still do the same core actions. So we took a risk to grow into China in about 2014-15, and we stuffed it up two times before we got it right. It took us about 3 years to get it right. And that took a lot of capital is basically what occurred, because, you know, taking on, it's almost like selling ice to the Eskimos in terms of selling the marketing services and tools that we have to China, which is where a lot of these activation tools are actually created. So it took a lot of capital. A lot of our funding and growth was financed from working capital, because we're ostensibly a business that is not capital intensive. So our working capital is funding our growth. And there were some real challenges in those early days, and we had enormous growth in China. The first year in China, we did 2 million. The next year, we did 5. The next year, we did 4. The next year, we did 8. The next year, we did 16 in revenue. And growing from 2 to 4 million from working capital is okay, but you start growing from 16 million to 30 million, we were basically doubling every 2 years. That's a lot of working capital to cover. And what we basically had was a bit of a perfect storm in 2016, where we had enormous growth, particularly in China. During this time as well, we'd started a regional expansion strategy where we were, I think at that stage, probably into another 2 or 3 countries, like New Zealand, like Vietnam as well. And that was obviously taking capital. And then what we had was a perfect storm of a slight dip in sales, maybe a 15% dip in sales in the Australian business. And at the same time, for completely unrelated issues, we had 2 of our major debtors in Australia who couldn't pay their bills. One was undergoing a massive ERP and accounting package restructure and basically stuffed it up, and they owed us millions of dollars, and they literally couldn't pay any suppliers for about 5 months. And the other company, a major client of ours, had financial difficulties, and for very different reasons, they couldn't pay us at the same time. So we had this perfect storm of requiring capital and not having access to capital and not having the right capital structure to support the business growing at that stage. So it really did cause real challenges for us, and that was a very difficult time in 2016. You're right.
And how close did the business, so you're almost a victim of your own success, but how close did the business come to collapsing? Was it days, weeks? Did you always think, oh, we'll get through this? Was there any time where you sort of woke up at night and thought, this may be the end?
Yes. There was a couple of sleepless nights for sure. I don't know. In terms of putting a number on it, it was never like a day or a week away. It wasn't that clear cut. But what we had was a capital problem, cash flow problem, and what we had to do was keep trying to solve that. And we couldn't just trade through from it. So we had to go back to shareholders. We had to put everyone had to put loans in. Most of the shareholders, because this is a part of that philosophy that we've built the business on, is I encourage all key people who have helped build the business to have equity in the business. And what I would like to do is, in time, extend that to everyone who works in the business, because I think everyone deserves to be able to have control over their own future and to be able to direct it. So at the time where you're most vulnerable and you feel your own role, you know, the very existence of the company is challenged, you're asking the same people to put in personal savings and life savings at the same time. Like, you're doubling down almost. We also got access to capital from some very good financial partners, banking partners. And I also had a group of good friends that were mates that were able to, business professionals that were able to give some advice. And out of that advice, one of that led to our new banking partner. But it's all a matter of confidence with some of these things as well. Like, if you think you can get through it, 9 times out of 10 you will. If you think you can't get through it, it's very much your mental attitude with some of these things.
So at the same time that your business is imploding in a way, your daughter comes home and she tells you that one of her friends has had some tough times, and you and your wife, despite living in a at the time, a pretty small house and business probably not going as well as it had been, and you guys decided to take in two kids who are really, really struggling. Can you tell me what happened there?
Well, you have done your research, haven't you, Adam? it's probably been 4 years now, and so it was probably a year before this has happened. But no, it was an opportunity where my youngest daughter, Naya, who was in grade 4 at the time, one of her friends at school, unfortunately her mother had passed away from cancer, and her mum and dad were separated at the time. And unfortunately a year after that, her father passed away. And in that year where they were living with their dad, they started spending more and more time at our place, just because it made sense, because their dad found it difficult to look after them for different reasons. So, and we realised that during that time that the kids needed some help, and the school was aware of these things as well, but it was very clear that potentially if someone didn't do something, these kids were going to slip through the cracks. So they started coming to our house for dinner to make sure that was cool, and having showers and doing their homework and different things. And then that, you know, started out with just Eloise. And then she said, hey, I've got an older sister at home called Charlotte. She's at home by herself. Can she come over? And we said, sure. And then we had the chance to meet Charlotte. And then one thing led to another, and then their dad got sicker, and then eventually he passed away. And during that time, the community was trying to help, but, you know, it's one of those things that it's hard. So everyone's busy with their own lives and everyone's got challenges with their own kids. But if something isn't done sometimes, people, you know, people just become statistics. And my wife, particularly Michelle, she was amazing. She was very committed towards helping. And one of the key things, as she said at the time, like part of what Zinc does is we sponsor and are a community partner to Cambodian Kids Foundation. And we dedicate a decent percentage of our profits to supporting nearly 500 people, which is about 120 families in one of the poorest parts of Cambodia, and including schooling and health and hygiene. And she challenged and she said, look, you're happy to do these things for people you don't even know, and yet there's two kids that live around the corner that are going to slip through the cracks if we don't do something. And everyone is all, you know, talking the talk, but you've actually got to do something. You've got to take action because talk's cheap. And if we don't do anything, these kids could fall through the cracks. So we need to step up. And the challenge was, if their dad passed, and he was expected to pass, is the girls are most likely going to be split up. And, you know, Michelle was incredibly powerful in terms of that not happening, because that was going to make an incredibly challenging situation for these girls even more challenging, because they were struggling. I mean, you can imagine being in grade four and grade six and then your mum passing and then a year later your dad passing. You know, what do you do? And it's not like they were together. You know, their mum and dad were divorced. So they were in an incredibly challenging situation. So we made the decision. We talked to our kids. Our kids, Naya and Charlie, were absolutely fantastic. And we, as a family, we made the decision to open ourselves up to something that we had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. And I guess, you know, the philosophy you have in life is what you take with your family or what you take with your business. You can't separate the two. And I think that's the authenticity that most people in life are looking for, whether if it's friendships or you're working in businesses or you're a leader in a business. People talk about authentic leadership. To me, that's what it is, and it's to do the hard things when it's really hard. And sometimes you don't choose to when these things happen, but they come up in life and you choose to either take action and do something, or you choose not to do anything. And so as a family, we chose to help. And we took formal guardianship of the girls. It was 4 years ago now, 2016. And they've been with us ever since. And it's been the hardest thing I think we've ever done in our lives. And it was very difficult at the business at the same time. Like, it was almost like a perfect storm, because the first 2 years were just a nightmare.
And just like that, things had come full circle for Pete and his family. They were back to sharing a two-bedroom, one-bathroom home between four kids and two adults. Just like when Pete was a kid. Pete and Michelle had plans to extend the family home, but with the business sideswiping them financially, they just couldn't afford it. But eventually, and very slowly, things started to get better. Some of their early investments were paying off, and Zinc was becoming cash flow positive. And just when things were starting to improve, COVID-19 happened, and few industries were impacted as much as the marketing sector. Even worse, a big part of Zinc's business was working with the film and cinema industry to create and sell merchandise. But with cinemas shutting down around the world, the market for their merchandise disappeared. What do you do? This is sort of February 2020, and you're once again faced with another cataclysmic event, and you've got to pivot.
Absolutely. And I think it was certainly something that no one had expected. And the globally, like with cinemas shutting down and, you know, restaurants and gyms, nothing like this has ever happened before. So it certainly wasn't something anyone had planned for, because it's almost impossible to do so. What we'd also started doing is we've merged with a German company mid last year in 2019. And so we were just completing that merge, which was sort of two-thirds Zinc, one-third this company. So we're at the tail end of that process as well when this all hits. So we did what we did in the GFC. We brought the team together because it's all built on culture. So we're radically transparent with information. So we brought the team together as one unit and said, look, this is the situation we're in from a profit and a loss perspective and from a cash flow perspective. We put it all out on the table in terms of letting them know the position of the company, that we had good cash reserves, but we don't know how long this is going to last and we don't know how bad it's going to get. So we've got to protect all of our, the whole team for as long as we can. And to do that, what we have to do is decide how we're going to do that. So we've got to reduce our cash outflows. And so we took all the normal steps in terms of talking to banking partners and trying to minimise that. But the biggest costs we have, 80% of our costs are people. So we said to the guys, look, there's a percentage of people, 8 or 10 people in this room that can't be here, or everyone can take a 10% pay cut. And like we did in the GFC, it's we'd like you guys tell us what you'd like to do. Do you want to think of yourselves or do you want to think of your teammates? And it was one of the proudest moments I've had because everyone decided to take the pay cut and protect their teammate, which is awesome. And the leadership group had already taken a 20% pay cut. And because we're in the cinema business, in terms of what you were talking about, we had movies. This is maybe about 2 weeks before the pandemic truly hit. It had already been hitting in China, which we'd been watching, and it had affected our business there. So we'd already had some forewarning. I didn't think it had hit as hard as it has. I don't think anyone did. But we knew that it was going to be impacting that part of our business. So we're already taking some precautionary actions. But when it truly hit, we were probably maybe a couple of weeks ahead of everyone else just because of the exposure we'd already had to China. So we started culturally with the people and made sure that we could protect our team for as long as we can. We then went through the business planning process that most people do in terms of optimising their cash flows and ensuring that we can trade through this. But then we realised that this wasn't going to get us as far as we wanted, and we'd made a public commitment to protect all team members and not let anyone go. And we were going to do what was needed to be done. So we were looking to raise capital from shareholders again and from some of our banking partners. But in the midst of this, it then became an opportunity to pivot our business, and it's an overused word now, but to adapt our business, because literally cinemas were shut, so we had a whole team not doing anything. How do we keep them engaged? And this is where this personal protective equipment or PPE market segment suddenly became apparent to us, that there was an opportunity here to be able to explore this and maybe see if we can't help our clients get through this period. So we started talking to our clients from a PPE perspective. We'd had exposure to this previously through our promotional side business, where we had some experience already with this, but we had all the supply chains, all our core competencies are set up to be able to adapt quickly. And our whole culture is built around adaptability and flexibility. So we had 4 offices in China. We had the teams in place from a technology perspective, from a sourcing, supply and quality control perspective already. We had obviously very talented account management and good strategy people. And so basically what we started doing is exploring some of these opportunities with clients, and what one opportunity led to another. And we started doing a very good job, and that's basically where this has extended to, where we're dealing with very large corporates, in America and some governments as well, in Europe and in Australia and New Zealand was tremendously successful as well.
So your business was pre-COVID-19 doing on the way to $100 million in sales, which is self-incredible, and that looked like going to significantly less. Not zero, but a lot less. And just to get an understanding of the scale of, I'm not sure if you can say, but the scale of your PPE business in probably less than 3 months, what kind of sales do you think you'll end up with this financial year from PPE?
It's a good question. We were probably heading towards $85 or $90 million pre our merger/acquisition with our new German partner. Post that merger, we were probably going to be about $120 or $130 million. And we had plans to be a $200 million company within 2 years.
So I guess, but you certainly aren't the kind of guy who obviously you're an entrepreneur and you've had many businesses now, many different pivots in your business, but it doesn't sound like you're a guy who went into business to get incredibly rich. You came into business to help people and to build great things. Do you have an end game? Is there a, do you just look 5 or 10 years into the future and know where you want to get to? Or is it, are you sort of, we'll let just go wherever the road takes you.
We're quite planned. I guess the key thing is when Michelle and I got married, we had a bit of a pact between ourselves that we would live lives that would be self-determined. So what we didn't want to do was let other people determine what we were going to do and how we were going to live. So I think that's pretty much guided us since, you know, for the last 25 years and everything we've done is to be able to self-determine where we want to go and what we're trying to do within the scope, you know, of what's possible. So in terms of living to that philosophy, from a business perspective, I certainly need to achieve, from a personal perspective, a certain level of wealth, if that's the right word, or success, financial success, whatever you want to call it, to be able to do some of the things that we'd like to do in terms of being self-determining. Because I'd love to travel, like when the kids are older, I'd love to travel more. Like there's a range of things, you know, everyone makes sacrifices you're going through. There's a range of things that I would like to do, that Michelle would like to do, and that we'd like to do together as we can. And that's from a personal perspective. From a business perspective, like what I'm like at home with the kids, or what I'm like with my brothers and sisters or mum, or what I'm like at work, it's the same person. So from a business perspective, we've also had that self-determining. So whilst a business can't just be about profit, you have to be profitable and successful because you've got to keep reinvesting. So I'm aiming to achieve a minimum level of wealth to be able to, and for that you need a business to be able to perform at a certain level to be able to facilitate what you want to do in the future. We talk to the team regularly. I don't necessarily want to be a billion-dollar business. Like we don't actually have a final growth target from a business perspective that we want to hit. I guess what we want to do is keep doing great work with a great group of people, and if you can do that, you're going to have success and you're going to keep building a business. And what I'm realizing now is it's probably not up to me to dictate at what level or size or scope a business can be. So we've got a bit more of an emergent strategy now from a business perspective in terms of broadly we know where we're going, but the details are something that we're going to be, and I mean, this is what the last 3 months have taught us, that the best laid plans are going to change rapidly depending on what opportunities or challenges occur. So, I mean, we've now achieved our 2022 goals this year. I mean, we haven't had time to catch our breath quite yet. And we've got two or three more acquisitions lined up, smaller ones, that we want to roll in to help strengthen the team and the structure, the infrastructure of the business. Once we do that, I could imagine that we will be recalibrating what we would like to do as a team and as a group of people. So it's not just me deciding, it's the leadership group, but it's the broader team as well, because we've got to keep engaging our team and offering them opportunities and challenges. And so some of that could be moving geographically. Some of that could be a new division. Some of that could be just focusing on the core of what we're doing. But I would like to think that probably for the next 3 years, our broad strategy is right now, and what we'll then see is how far that growth can go. But as long as we don't lose the culture, I would stop growing the business if I thought the culture was going to be diluted to a point where it's going to affect our success, because you need both to be able to keep doing what we're doing.
You'll be glad to know that Pete has finally finished renovating his house and his four kids don't have to share the same bedroom anymore. As for his business, Zinc continues to grow from strength to strength. That was Pete Cleary, founder and CEO of Zinc, and you've been listening to From Zero with me, Adam Schwab. Our producer is Lindsay Green. Audio producer, Darcy Thompson. For more episodes, search From Zero Podcast with me, Adam Schwab.
Listener.